You get it in Plato, you get it in the Neoplatonists, you get it also in the Egyptian teachings, in the Tibetan book, in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. So you get it in many, many forms, that our process is one not just of expanding consciousness, but the effect of that expanded consciousness on every vehicle at every single level. And I think we see this, if you've been a meat eater at some stage in your life and you stopped, the vehicle changes. If you've smoked, it changes. And certainly this is true. The vehicle becomes more sensitive.
This is the basis for the new progress in medicine.
Yes.
It's the realization of the mind-body continuum. Yes. Not a connection,
not
but a continuum.
A continuum.
Realizing that the body, emotion, physical continuum is always a wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And that when there's any change at all in the inner worlds,
yes,
which are formative,
mm-hmm,
the inner attitude, the inner psychology, mm-hmm, it immediately impacts at the cellular level,
mm-hmm,
throughout the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so really,
yes,
even in the future, we'll,
mm-hmm,
be more and more geared toward,
mm-hmm,
changing our inner states of consciousness.
Yes.
Professor During has also done some groundbreaking work to show what I guess many of us realize is that it's a two-way process,
mm-hmm,
and that the body, mm-hmm, tells the mind. It's not just the mind telling the body.
Yes, this is true. So it's a total transformation. And sometimes I have wondered, speculation, pure speculation, if there doesn't come a time when, well, let me put it this way, that for the vast majority of us, and I think we're more or less ordinary, everyday people, for the vast majority of us, almost any matter, in quotes, at any level, would suffice for building the vehicle that's necessary. But that there would come a time, for example, a Mahatmic consciousness, where the vehicle has to be composed, if I can put it this way, of matter that has been so refined that it would simply be a reconstitution of previous vehicles, because there wouldn't be enough matter that refined to build completely new. Do you know what, see what I'm getting at? Anyway, it's just an idea, speculation. But for the most of us, being rather ordinary people, practically any matter would do, you know. But there must come levels where finer and finer grades of matter are required. Yes.
You think so?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
There's something there that, mm-hmm, you say, well,
mm-hmm,
for example, Audrey Hepburn,
mm-hmm,
she was a very special person.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're making a film of someone who looks like Audrey.
Yes.
It doesn't have the,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And perhaps this is part of what is recognized in the whole process of tolku, but also what is recognized in the whole identification of say the Dalai Lama, the characteristics, and consequently it's exhibitable. I don't know if there's such a word, but it's a nice word. Exhibitable at even the physical level. And they carry an aura or a presence about them. And in that very aura or presence, something, it happens. And one's own consciousness is heightened. Marie?
There's an anthology out that's very interesting called Buddhist Women on the Paradox of Embodiment.
Yes.
In that anthology is an article titled Tulku. It's written by a woman who has been a long-time body worker, and she has worked with many Tibetan monks and nuns and so forth. She said that very few of them embody the Tulku quality in the actual matter of the body. But she said, when one works with someone who is truly enlightened, the matter of the body has a different quality altogether in the sense that it is not patterned. And this can be felt with the hands. It doesn't have the
That's
same resistance, the same, she calls it patterning. It's, she says that it feels more akin to light, and it's elastic, easy to work with.
So that's interesting.
That is
very
interesting.
That's very interesting because that bears out what I've been trying to express. Yes, Barbara.
Along the lines what you were expressing, and also on, of course, I'm sorry, I don't know what her name.
Maria Paris.
Maria was expressing in our center where we had available four rooms, and where we saw people by themselves in each of the rooms using acupressure, meditation, and therapeutic touch. We would find that sometimes the energy, whether we were working on the physical, it didn't matter because all four bodies were being touched or balanced at the same time. So, and sometimes that energy, wherever it was coming from, could be recycled exactly by the next person. It was what the next person needed. However, there were occasions when that energy would become so thick and so solid and so almost gross, and that kind of thing, that those rooms would need to be left for a period of time. And it goes along with what you were saying, is that there were times when that could not be absorbed by the persons that were coming in at that particular time. However, something did happen to it in the matter of the of using this, we would construct a light center in our own center. So something would happen to it in the matter of 24 hours, so that was changed in some kind of way. That it, nothing was ever wasted. So it kind of goes along with what she's saying. And also another thing we found out with people who would come in for cosmetic surgery, unless things were done on the energy field before and after, the cosmetic surgery was not as clear, or the changes was not as clear, and did stay in the same kind of way as if the fields went changed.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you, Barbara, for that. Very interesting. So these interconnections, these interrelationships are very tangible.
Rami Ravindas spoke about that also.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
That the way of walking you can see.
Yes.
And they describe the Buddha's body as so beautiful and so radiant.
Yes.
The four-out stone, the silken garments of the
Buddha. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, we've moved a long way, but perhaps all of interest. And I think there was something. In the manual of Abhidharma, the ninth and or the no the final chapter of the seventh yes, the final chapter of the seventh book of the Abhidharma, because each book has several chapters, of course, is concerned not with theory but with practice. And consequently, the statement is made that all the theoretical analysis of mind and matter, and it analyzes matter in relation to mind, in relation to consciousness, and mind in relation to matter, finally converges upon the practice of meditation. And the practice culminates in the attainment of the supreme goal of Buddhism, the liberation of the mind by non-clinging. So this whole study, which Sinnott was directed to undertake, I think is one that is extremely important for us to pursue, to try to understand. Not that we need to perhaps go into all of these factors, 56 factors that follow on what happens in the formula, but rather to recognize this in a sense, two forces that are involved in this persistent struggle, even with ourselves, that there is both diversity, as one writer, Nyanaponika, one of the Buddhist monks, in writing about Abhidhamma studies, that there is no complete identity nor no complete diversity, and that within the totality there is both identity and diversity, and that therefore it's a continual process of assimilating and dissimilating, as it were, so that there is always this equilibrium. And arising out of that, then, is this understanding, if you like, of a state of mind which is ever in its own nature. And that is nirvana. That is the ultimate nirvana. That there are several stages, as it were, several aspects of nirvana, in which, therefore, there's a nirvanic condition, as it said, of the seventh principle, which then permeates one's entire being, because there is no attachment, no clinging, no grasping, and yet one acts. This again, it comes back to the Gita. You act because it is the very nature to act, but there is no motive that is in any way associated with a personal self. And so in that condition, or HPB calls it a kind of laic condition, in which then, and she quotes Shankaracharya, when the disciple, having attained that primeval consciousness, absolute bliss, of which the nature is truth, which is without form and action, abandons this elusive body that has been assumed by Atma, then one moves in that perfect equipoise, which is nirvana. So the combination of karma and nirvana is not, as it may seem at first, dissimilar, but rather that by understanding all of the interrelationships that are there, which are karmic impulses, then one comes to that wholesome condition, which is nirvana. Consequently, as Nagarjuna could put it, nirvana is samsara. Samsara is nirvana. Between the two, there is no difference. So you can see why this is being said to him, to Sinnet, and I think why it's said to us today. It's the same thing. HPB points out, it must not be supposed that anything can go into nirvana which is not eternally there. It's only in the attitude. In the attitude. One's mental attitude. Well, there's more, but I think we've spent so much time on 68. So we might begin tomorrow by looking then at 70, a few things that we will take up. But I would mainly like to turn to some of the other things that are pointed out about Eliphas Levi's article on death that I think may be useful to us. And I'm not sure where that will leave us for the final morning of Thursday, but we'll think of something to do on Thursday.
Chapter 17?
Yes, I gave you the notes already. Gave you the notes last week.
So.
And maybe we, by that time we'll be in Devachan. I got you to Nirvana today. That should suffice. Okay.
Here is the chauffeur.
Must have shown great strength to begin with.
The Mahatma Letters, Session 11.
It's been wonderful to have so many, I must say, friends of mine, too, from overseas. And we're sorry to lose Bev and Gavin today, and then others tomorrow, and gradually on then Friday morning. And Saturday, John leaves, and so it begins to feel very empty, I must say. And that's right, as though they've left us behind somehow. Well, a little bit first of unfinished business from yesterday. Cecil has put on the board the works that he's referred to. There are many other works on dependent origination. There's one by Kumaraswamy, but there are many, many works on Buddhism that deal with the theory of dependent origination, or sometimes called interdependent origination, that we discussed yesterday. And I know it's not easy reading, Psychological Attitude. It's the psychological attitude of early Buddhist philosophy. I know it's not easy, but it's absolutely essential, and it has many, many diagrams. And I would strongly recommend that if you want to go into it, you go into that. The foundations of Tibetan mysticism does not have that much, although it has some on dependent origination. But psychological attitude of early Buddhist philosophy puts it in its perspective in a magnificent way. As I say, there are many other works that deal with this. And I also brought along, because this is, we mentioned it, the work on Nagarjuniana. This is a series of studies in the writings and philosophy of Nagarjuna. And really quite an outstanding text that is very helpful in understanding these twin doctrines, karma and nirvana, and deals with it from the point of view of the Majjhimika philosophy of Buddhism. And this work on Nagarjuna's philosophy I have found extremely interesting. This is the Motilal Banarsidass, Venkata Ramanan, which again deals with this whole subject of the ultimate and the real, the mundane and the ultimate truth, the whole theory of dependent origination, the sense of I concepts, and so on, and the middle way, the Majjhimika philosophy. So those I brought along. Then on the Abhidhamma, this is the one that I have used most, is by Narada, a manual of Abhidhamma, which has diagrams and very helpful understanding in that. Not easy, not at all easy, but again, showing the complexity of the thought processes. And then this is a simpler one, researches in Buddhist psychology, the Abhidhamma studies. And this also gives you very briefly the classification of wholesome consciousness, What is wholesome consciousness? At the time when, or when this occurs, the when or at the time, not a specific time, as we said yesterday, but the right moment, kairos, the appropriate moment when all things come together, which are the things that are wholesome. And then it goes through endless lists, but very interesting listing of the conditions that are must be present. It's a kind of concatenation of everything, perhaps summarized by the statement by the Mahatma, motive is everything. Motive must be there, but it's an intentionality. It's present in all of the sense of purpose, a sense of the rightness, that you have come to a point where everything converges, as it were. And it's so I'll leave these here today to that you can look
at.
Hmm?
Who wrote that one?
This is the one I was quoting from, Naya Panaka Tara.
How do you spell it?
You can come up. This is put out by the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka or Ceylon. And the Tara, T-H-E-R, indicates Theravadin, that he's a monk of the Southern Buddhist school, therefore. And the types of consciousness and the parallel factors. Not easy, but this gives much more of a kind of condensation if you want to really understand what the Abhidhamma that's been mentioned. Then I brought along, now where is it? Because this came up yesterday. This is volume 14, if I remember correctly. Yes, volume 14 of the collected writings. And it is in this that we have this wonderful article published posthumously by but written by HPB, The Mystery of Buddha. And this came up yesterday when we were talking about Shankaracharya. So this is volume 14 of the collected writings, page 388. And just to read a couple of statements from it, which amplifies what we were talking about yesterday with regard to Shankaracharya, using some of the vehicles. HPB says, "Now the mystery of Buddha lies in this. Gautama, an incarnation of pure wisdom, had yet to learn in his human body," and this repeats the statement HVB makes so often, that every step has to be taken in human incarnation. "So had yet to learn in his human body and to be initiated into the world's secrets like any other mortal." So it had to be done in incarnation. And so then goes on that Gautama had sworn inviolable secrecy as to the esoteric doctrines imparted to him. In his immense pity for the ignorance and as its consequence the sufferings of mankind, desirous though he was to keep inviolate his sacred vows, he failed to keep within the prescribed limits. So this is what I was repeating yesterday. So was Shankaracharya Gautama the Buddha then under a new personal form? It may perhaps only puzzle the reader the more if he be told that there was the, quote, astral, quote, Gautama inside the outward Shankara. So this is what I was trying to explain yesterday, in terms of the fact that that is, when she says astral, this is the material, the substance, as it were, of the vehicles inside the outward Shankara, whose higher principle, or Atman, was nevertheless his own divine prototype, the heavenly mind-born son of Aditi. And this fact is again based on that mysterious transference of the divine ex-personality merged in the impersonal individuality, now in its full Trinitarian form of the monad as Atma Buddhi Manas. So the Trinitarian form is Atma Buddhi Manas, because Atma Buddhi is passive until energized by Manas. So merged in the impersonal individuality to a new body, whether visible or subjective. The Buddha is in nirvana, it is said, though this once mortal vehicle of Gautama is still present among the initiates, nor will it leave the realm of conscious being so long as suffering mankind needs its divine help. So, Shankara was an avatara in the full sense of the term. He is held to be as an avatara, or direct incarnation of Shiva, the Logos, the seventh principle in nature, himself. So, but embodies or uses the material of the Buddha, of Gautama's vehicles. This is the great mystery. So it's absolutely necessary, she says, to study the doctrine of the Buddhas esoterically and understand the subtle differences between the various planes of existence to be able to comprehend correctly the above. When a Shankaracharya has to be born, naturally every one of the principles in the manifested mortal man must be the purest and finest that exist on earth. So that's what I was trying to explain, that it was that material which was the purest and finest, because the vehicle of Gautama had indeed been the vehicle through which enlightenment had been achieved. Consequently, those principles that were once attached to Gautama, who was the great predecessor, direct great predecessor of Sankara, were naturally attracted to him. So you begin to see this relationship. So was Sankara Charya a reincarnation? Well, yes and no, in a sense, do you see? The economy of nature forbidding the re-evolution of similar principles from the crude state. So we're all using each other's matter, so we put it that way. But this, I think, is an extremely helpful to in the understanding of this whole thing. But it must be remembered that the higher ethereal principles are not, like the lower, more material ones, visible sometimes to man, and they have to be regarded in the light of separate or independent powers or gods rather than as material objects. So, hence the right way of representing the truth would be to say that the various principles, the Bodhisattva of Gautama Buddha, which did not go to nirvana, reunited to form the middle principles of Sankaracharya, the earthly entity. So this is what I was basing my statements yesterday on. And I think the whole article is certainly well worth studying, and it's a fairly long one, and it's then there's another article. Oh, of course, she says, the close of Sankaracharya's life brings us face to face with a fresh mystery. So that's the conclusion of the article. You have another mystery. Because he retired to a cave in the Himalayas, permitting none of his disciples to follow him, and disappears therein forever from the sight of the profane. Is he dead? So, well, read on for the answer. And this is followed by an article she wrote called Reincarnations, in quote, of Buddha, and an unpublished discourse of Buddha. which is found in the second book of commentaries and addressed to the Arhats. Anyway, what am I done wrong now? I'm too loud? Oh, okay, all right. So I brought those along today to sort of complete what we had talked about yesterday in letter 68. Yes?
It sounds like that's tied in with those seven mysteries that you was talking to in letter 68.
It probably is. I think it very definitely is.
One of them, it sounds like the in the three vestures, mm-hmm. it sounds like that emanation body.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But it all sounds like a
yes.
real
so,
mystery.
Now, a bodhisattva is a nirmanakaya, according to HPB, the same. So it would be at that level, yeah. So the bodhisattva body, which becomes the nirmanakaya, is taken on by Shankaracharya.
Can we assume then that that Shankaracharya was a fully enlightened being?
Probably. Well, at the same time, as she says, the monad was his own, but he used the material. So, I think probably Shankaracharya was enlightened. He was the greatest of the Advaita Vedantins, and introduced really, well, there's some controversy, and that's why I did the weekend on the Vashishta, because it said that Shankaracharya followed Vashishta in the line of sages. And so, but I would think that Shankaracharya, as the great Advaita Vedantin, showing the relation between Vedanta and Buddhism then, was really enlightened.
Doesn't HPB refer to him as the greatest initiation?
Oh, yeah.
Initiate, I mean.
He's one of, yes, the initiate. So does that mean fully enlightened? I don't know. But certainly must be.
Do you think that if he hadn't been, he could have used the material available?
Well, probably, I think that's true, Joan, yes. There's certainly a great mystery to it, and we really don't fully understand it, but all I could do was try to explain as I understand it, and I've pondered over it for a long time, because I think it is a remarkable. And the fact of the economy of nature, you know, as she puts it, that no material is lost, mm-hmm. or at any level.
They probably have to stand in line to use the best material available.
So this again, you see, from a practical point of view, from our point of view, the practical point of view is that we are, in one sense, I like to put it this way, but may be rather grossly oversimplified, but in a certain sense, each of us is responsible for the refining and purifying of matter at all of the levels of the in the human constitution, so that we are gradually preparing humanity and the earth, because there's the two develop paripasu. For the next round, for the fifth round. And so it's by the refining of the material, the purifying of the material, at every level of our present constitution, that we can then make that available for, I'm not trying to be superior in this, but for those that may be coming along, who need that kind of material, or who for whom that will be represent a next step in the evolution. And this indeed is the economy of nature, as it were, that this is our responsibility to have that kind of material that will be useful for vehicles for the oncoming group. Just as hierarchies preceding us of Dian Chohans, you see, somewhere HPB, and I think it's in It's in Anthropogenesis, says, I think it's there, that the best of us, and I take that not just the best of us in being goody-goody and so on, but the best of us in terms of the vehicles that we have been using, the best of us will be Dian Chohans in the next round. So this is what we are in the process of doing, by expanding consciousness, but by purifying and ennobling the matter at the karmic and even the physical level. We're working at this. And it's our responsibility. It's as though you've been given a plot of land, so to speak, and told to make it beautiful, you know. And so there you are working away at getting it in order. And I think of it as a tremendous responsibility.
Mm-hmm. In the Bible.
In the Bible is the story of the talents. Yes, it is.
It does make the point that we're a closed system.
Yes.
And also that the millions of years of evolution right through the other kingdoms of nature we're doing precisely this. We're evolving the material
yes.
at every level of life.
At every level.
To be used.
That's right.
And it it can't be used until we've evolved it through to the human level.
Uh-huh. So it's
since you also talk about the Tsongkhapa as a kind of incarnation of the Buddha.
Yes, indeed. Tsongkhapa was an incarnation and undoubtedly used that material.
Yes.
And of course it was Tsongkhapa that gave the signs, the marks by which the Dalai Lama, for example, Dalai Lamas would be recognized. Yes, Tsongkhapa was in that. And undoubtedly another incarnation, so to speak, of the Buddha, of Shankaracharya, whatever, in that line. And this is why I think, where was it? Was it in this letter? Which letter was it? No, 18, letter 18 that we looked at. That statement was made, I think it was in 18, that he was advised, Sinnet was advised, to make a, wasn't it in 18, to make a list, as it were, to trace, maybe it was one of the other letters, but he was told to trace the outpouring, of, or the line of descent of the the sages and this thread through the ages. Was that in 18? Can't remember now. Sorry. But he is told that at one point, and I don't see it at the moment, but anyway, he was told that. And it, if when you do that, you see this what is called the Guru Parampara, the line of descent of gurus, of teachers, of sages, of wise ones, the company of the saints in Christian terminology, so that you begin to trace these and you see the commonalities of the teaching adapted to each culture, each civilization, and so on.
Is this not true also for the West?
Yes.
It is for the East.
Oh, it is.
And perhaps even more so true for the West to try to find that.
To find that line, yes. And who is to say but what Plato used some of the vehicle, although they were, it couldn't have been because of the dating, as it were. But who is, you know, and perhaps because Plato was a fifth rounder, that... perhaps Plotinus used some of the vehicles, or some of the matter of the vehicles of Plato.
Perhaps Plato used some of Pythagoras.
Yes, could be. So it's interesting to trace this in that way.
We have it also in the Voice of the Silence that the earlier incarnation
of the master Cage, it was Nagarjuna.
Yes, of course, that's right, that Cage was Nagarjuna, yes. So this is where all of this, I think, really begins to come together. Now, I wanted to turn today, there's still very much, of course, in letter 68 that we haven't touched upon, but we have only today and tomorrow, somehow. And I thought tomorrow we would use the time really to sort of bring everything together, questions and comments. Not that I can answer all the questions, I certainly can't, but perhaps bringing together what we've been studying. We've only accomplished two letters. My vision was we would zip through and we'd have all of these other letters, you know, 70 and 85 and 104, and we'd have everything all neatly tied up and you'd know all about the matters of life and death, which is what I called it, called this series. But we've managed to get through two letters, well, not fully two letters, but pretty well through two letters. But so I thought today I'd like to spend time looking at not so much at letter 70C, but what it refers us to, and that is some of the teachings of this very interesting person, Eliphas Levi, whose article in 1881, October 1881, the Theosophist publishes an article by this very interesting person. This is a pseudonym for an abbe, French abbe, Louis Constant. Not sure I pronounced the French correctly. Joan, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-T. It's page 501, but it doesn't give his right name there. Anyway, it would be English in Constant, but what's the French, Joan? Constant, I would think. Constant. That was what my French came up with, Constant. He was born in... Now, this is interesting. Eliphas Levi was born in 1810, and he died in 1875. I'm not sure how his manuscripts came into HPB's possession. But, of course, she traveled, as we know, widely. She was in Paris, and certainly in many occasions, and we know that she was in Paris in 1873 when she then left Paris to come to the United States and the society was founded. But whether she had met him earlier, I don't know. I mean, this is one of the interesting things one can try to pursue. Anyway, he was the son, it's interesting, he was the son of a poor shoemaker in Paris. May remind you of, who was the shoemaker? Yes. The father could not afford to educate him, but he showed such remarkable intelligence that the curé of the parish became interested in him. And with the consent of his parents, he was placed in a seminary where he was trained to become a priest. Well, he began to have, as he progressed, he began to have some very grave doubts about some of the Catholic doctrines. This isn't really very helpful in the... This is around... He was born in 1810, so this is around 1820-25 and so on. And he started penetrating into the mysteries of occultism, what was available at that particular time. Now, this is probably about the time of HPB's birth that he begins this inquiry. And he gave expression to some of these ideas on several occasions before he took his last vows. And he was sent as a punishment to an out-of-the-way monastery where he was kept a virtual prisoner for several months. I just thought you might like to know a little bit about his life, so I thought I'd bring that in. With mostly only bread and water for food. Now, the part of the monastery in which he lived was said to be haunted, and he once related a very curious incident in connection with this haunting. One night, and incidentally, he wasn't allowed to have any lights, any candles, of course, I mean, not electric lights, but obviously not then, but he wasn't allowed to have any light, either from the window or from candles. And one night...